Hello and welcome to another edition of Heart of Healthcare. My name is Dr. Jan Bonhoeffer, and these podcasts are about helping physicians restore balance in their lives so we can recreate a medical system that benefits everyone. A quick reminder that you can find more information about our nonprofit Heart-Based Medicine and the work we do to support healthcare professionals at heartbasedmedicine.org. We all know the situations when rules make sense, and when they are in support of quality and safety. We are also painfully aware of situations where rules lead to the opposite, and we are called to break them gracefully.
Welcome to the Heart of Healthcare podcast, Series 1, Episode 10. Today we're asking, when does it pay to break the rules?
So today we will set out to discuss how sometimes it's okay and maybe even necessary to break rules. And with that, let me welcome my beautiful colleagues and co-chairs, Dan Dinnenberg and Kavita Chinayan, for the 10th episode of this series. Welcome, Dan. Welcome, Kavita.
Hi, Kavita. Hi, Jan. Such a pleasure to be here.
Hi, Jan. Hi, Dan. It's so wonderful to be here with you both.
This is a really interesting conversation we may have today. As much of what we do, particularly in hospital medicine, but also in private practice, is bound by rules. And some of them are medical rules. Some of them come as ethical guidance. But some indeed are set by lawyers. And some are economic in nature. And I believe it would be a good start for us to see what is that moment in our career where we started to shift, if you like, from learning all the things we had to learn and from going by the rules and try to, you know, live up to the rules and the expectations. And what are those moments when those rules started to crumble and what made that happen? And for me, clearly, this was like an inspiring person. So this was an inspiring leader, an inspiring medical teacher. And then mainly it was the little patients, the little babies that I care for. They just are not aware of the rules. And, you know, how can you tell the hospital rules through a little baby looking into your eyes? So it is very difficult. So quite often, this is where I felt called to break the rules. Maybe let's take a round and let me ask you, Kavita, to start off with and say, do you remember a situation where you were inspired by, you know, a teacher, a guide, a patient indeed, to break the rules and when it felt right to break the rules?
Yeah, absolutely. And I've been very, very fortunate to have been have trained with some of the people in my field that would be considered mavericks and rebels because of how they approached medicine. And for instance, the chair of my department in cardiology when I was training, Dr. Bill O'Neill, he changed how patients coming in with heart attacks should be treated and published a series of studies where you could go in and do an angioplasty and open up the artery through this invasive procedure. And, you know, of course, people were doing that before that, but he was really instrumental in changing the way that is done, along with another one of my most admired people, Cindy Grimes. The two of them basically published a series of studies showing this to be true. And at that time when they published this in the 80s, they came under tremendous criticism because that's not how heart attacks were being treated. People were getting thrombolytics and they both have shared how they would go to conferences and present these results and they would be attacked you know, attacked in the conference by the audience, by other cardiologists, ridiculing them and bringing into question their ability as doctors and, you know, how unethical this was, or, you know, trying to bring in, you know, all kinds of criticism, and yet they kept on. And now it's the standard of care, and it has been the standard of care for 20 years. And nobody would think of treating a heart attack any other way in these patients. That is the first thing that we would do. And if you have the ability to do that, and the patient is the right patient, and you don't do that, now it's considered malpractice. Can you believe that? But at that time, they were breaking the rules by, you know, thinking outside the box. And similarly, you know, I have been really inspired by some of the early pioneers, you know, women in medicine who basically defied all odds, went to medical school and went and specialized in, you know, challenging specialties. And not only that, you know, some of these people, they came back and pointed out some of the flaws in the system and said, first of all, education is biased, and that needs to change. And then the way we are treating female patients is biased. There are not enough women being recruited in the trials. We are trying to apply male standards to women, and that's why they're not doing well. And publishing these data was unheard of, you know, when they started doing it, and then started designing trials to basically look at that and change the norm. And because of them, we have now this extensive body of literature saying this is true and things should be done differently. And now, you know, my generation and the next and the next is going to benefit from this, not only in our own academic careers and in our careers as women in medicine, for instance, but also how we treat female patients. And so, and all of this happened by breaking the rules. So just very inspiring, you know, very, very inspiring.
Well, thank you, Kavita. And two really important points, that medical breakthroughs actually come through individuals having the courage to think out of the box and take a courageous step forward mm-hmm. for what they see is clear, although it may not agree with the current law of the trade. And yeah. And not only technical advances, kind of medical advances, but also as a profession, so kind of cultural advances. So here, when you were talking about women stepping into the profession, I remember the biography of Maria Montessori in Italy, kind of starting out being the first woman in, among all these men, and having to sneak into the anatomy rooms at night when everybody else was gone, because that's the only time she was admitted, and kind of just going for it, convinced, and with this inner guidance. And this is so often what it takes, an inner clarity. And this is really fascinating to me. What is the source of this inner clarity that we sometimes feel so clearly that this is now required to do? Whether it's regarded right or wrong, this is what I'm required to do because it feels right. And we're not learning about this in medical school.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it takes clarity, but it really also takes courage to go to swim against the stream. You know, it takes that mentality of being a warrior, saying whatever, you know, whatever the consequences, I'm willing to take it. Because most of us don't have that courage to go against the system, which is why we become conformed through rules even when we don't like it, because we don't want to, you know, we don't like the bad outcomes, potential bad outcomes. But these people, they're revolutionary in that they don't care. And whether they're driven by science or their own, you know, their own cultural, social kind of or moral compass, doesn't matter. They still have the courage to go against the stream, which is the norm at the time.
It's so inspiring to hear Kavita speak of these mavericks in the field. And I actually just started to think about my own grandfather. Both my grandfathers were physicians. On my mom's side, my grandfather was the chief of medicine at Hahnemann. And what he did in his career was there was, at that time, there was a Women's College of Pennsylvania. And he was instrumental in bringing those institutions together. So there wasn't just a female medical school and a male medical school. So he would go and he taught in both places and started to integrate that. And in one lifetime, I end up enrolling and going to MCP Hahnemann, which is the combination of what was a women's college of medicine, which was very different from this sort of the male model. And so as I'm hearing of a maverick or an inspirational character, I'm looking to my own family and saying, this is a paradigm that is totally different. And I go, and I'm not sure exactly what the numbers were, but it was definitely predominantly 62% women by the time I got there. And this is the same family, generations of someone that's stepping in and knowing what was right. I think this continues, and you see these courageous individuals in medicine along the way. I think where I'm seeing it right now is there is a narrative around the pandemic, and there is a really important moment where some physicians that have ideas are scared, are nervous about putting it out there because they're going to be attacked for their thoughts, their science, their what they're looking at. And I just really admire those. I think that there's so much fear and uncertainty and just going along with the way that those that are pushing boundaries and, you know, just simply those that are expressing how to stay healthy or what is important in this time, these are the people that I'm reading and looking at because I'm like, this is exactly how Kavita put it. These are people that are now swimming upstream. And it seems so strange that that would be a warrior or a courageous, but that is. Putting it out there and saying, hey, this is my feelings. This is what I'm looking at. This is this with afraid of being shut down. Afraid of being called a quack, afraid of getting on a list right now, which is a very strange time in history. And even me bringing this up, that this would be like, oh, could this be controversial? Am I naming names here? Like, it's a really interesting time in history that if you feel something with clarity and you're bringing that up, that you might be attacked for being countercultural or against something, or, oh, now I'm going to be talked about, you know, oh, I'm an anti-vax because I'm even bringing up ideas about that. This is the time that we need people to bring up the ideas, people that have intelligence, that have experience, to start to think about that. And so you start to think about these rules and where they're made and whether it be a country that does something differently in response to a global pandemic, or if there's a region that does something. Like, this is okay because we're looking at the totality. We're learning from all of this. If everybody is doing the exact same thing and is just in response to a narrative that's given because no one's really thinking, then you start seeing things that are just bizarre. Just bizarre, you know? I mean, again, not to go into that thing, but like someone in their car by themselves, still with a mask on that I see consistently, or, you know, I mean, this is the strangest thing of being in Kauai, but you'll see someone paddleboarding out deep into the ocean with a mask on. And it's just like, what is happening here? Like, I don't care what you believe in. Like, that person is not at risk. They're surrounded by the Pacific Ocean with a mask on. It just doesn't seem intelligent, right? So, like, not to go deeply into that, but these are the things that almost can bring humor where you're like, you know what? I don't need to get controversial here, but there's something about that that I'm not really thinking is in alignment. So bringing in a lot of things there from family into this, but this is a place that we get to look at who is challenging assumptions, who is inspiring, who is standing up for what is right, their inner knowing. And that is who is ultimately I'm inspired by right now.
Ah, beautiful. Thank you. Thank you, Dan. This is what you're contrasting fear with courage. So Kavita talked about the courage that it takes to actually break the rules and to the trust to listen to this inner clarity, even though it might not make logical sense or agree with, you know, it's an inner clarity that can be followed based on trust. And you're contrasting this with the fear and with the almost sometimes humoristic and mindless fear that is generated. And to me, those moments when it hurts the most is kind of by those who set the toughest rules. That's where the fear comes up the most. And this is with the legal framework of what we're doing. I see for myself there's a fear of causing harm. Okay, there's a constant monitor in the back of my brain, in the back of my heart. It's like, am I doing the right thing here? So I want to serve the patient well. So there's like an inner moral standard or a rule that's, you know, first do no harm, right? So what can I do that is the case? But then there's an externally imposed rule, which in my world typically is either an economically driven or a legally driven rule that then kind of elicits fear here. So I'm afraid of a litigation, I'm afraid of being sued, I'm afraid of whatever the consequences might be, that then actually drive me to do things that in my heart don't really feel right and resonate. And that those are the really difficult moments for me in clinical care when kind of those values collide, when I feel that what has been set up maybe for a good reason has become an obstacle. So maybe before expanding on this, let me ask Kavita and Dan first about do you remember situations where you kind of found yourself in that crunch where you really felt professionally compromised as a physician based on kind of framework rules that you find yourself in?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is it's part of mainstream medicine, I would say, particularly in countries where litigation is so so foremost on everybody's mind. And what happens in this case is, of course, there is a courage and there is a conviction and, you know, and then there is the right intention. But what happens in society right now in medical practice, which is why, you know, administrators can keep us in line, is because of this not necessarily a fear per se, but it is the hassle of having to explain everything that you're doing, you know, so that you are not faced with this, with the consequence of litigation, even when you feel like inwardly that this decision is the best thing for this patient. You know, let me give you an example. For instance, you know, I was on inpatient service 2 weeks ago. And then, you know, we are rounding in the hospital on patients. And there is a 97-year-old woman who is admitted for, numerous medical problems. She has advanced dementia. And when you walk into her room, it's heartbreaking. it's heartbreaking because you feel like nobody should live this way. You know, there's no difference between, you know, what happens in dementia, as you know, is when the prefrontal cortex is gone, you are no different than an animal. You know, like you lose your language ability, the ability to make decisions. And you know what happens with dementia. Advanced dementia. This woman was just, you know, in this stage where she was not even vocal except for continuous primal sound, bathed in her own filth. And, you know, the issue here is she has numerous medical problems, and her children wanted full care, including whatever it took. If it required a surgery, if it required an invasive procedure, you know, you have to do it. Whereas any physician in their right mind would see that's not what you want to do for this patient. If it was my parent, and these are kinds of decisions I have made for my own family. So there is nothing I would do for a patient that I would not do for my own family, right? The intention is clear. And the knowledge and the heart, both the heart and the mind are very clear. But in this case, what do you do? Because the family is so hellbent on having, you know, on seeing a particular outcome of this parent that you can't reason with them. Right. And then you are stuck with this, with this dilemma on what to do. And this is where you have to involve the hospital administrators and the ethics committee and so on and so forth. And at that point, you're actually kind of glad that there is somebody else who can come in with some legalities and some, you know, some kinds of protocols that you don't have to get completely involved with, right? So in those cases, it's actually a good thing to have certain rules and somebody else that you can fall back on. But these are not unusual kinds of cases. These are the kinds of things that we face day to day in one way or another. So, and you feel like your ability to provide care is being compromised because of the decisions you would make if you didn't have to deal with that. Particularly in countries where you are really, you know, that issue of being sued is always at the back of our minds, right? And so documentation and so on and so forth has to be immaculate. If not, you will be sued. And nobody wants that. Who wants that hassle, right? So, you know, that is one way. And for me personally, because I've had extensive training in some of the Eastern traditions like Ayurveda, and I bring that into my medical practice, and because it doesn't gel with mainstream medicine, and, you know, it was actually a dilemma for me when I started bringing it into my medical practice, because a lot of the things like the diet and, you know, a lifestyle that I prescribe will not make sense to somebody who doesn't know what I'm talking about. You know, I can provide the scientific data and stuff, but it may not make sense to somebody who's not familiar with it. And then, you know, you don't want to be called a quack, right? But, you know, personally, I made the decision to say, I don't care what anyone thinks. I know what works. And with patients, as long as they want to try it, I will prescribe it. And what I say is, you do it. If it works for you, see, you know, it speaks for itself. And if it doesn't, then we'll try something else. So, but now I'm not afraid to speak about it when I'm giving a talk to the fellows or, you know, to my colleagues, because I'm like the preventive cardiologist that is always asked to give talks. And I bring in my training from Ayurveda, and I'm not ashamed of it. And even though it goes kind of, you know, above a lot of people's heads, I don't care. And, you know, so these are, you know, difficult decisions, I think, in individual physician's life, but we just have to take these chances. I guess it's also the issue of getting older and caring less about what anybody else thinks.
I couldn't agree more. It's it takes a lot to bring in the wisdom and of medicines that are thousands of years old, tried and tested, and our current kind of very young Western approach to science, according to the rules of the philosophy of science, that they, you know, we haven't quite caught up with thousands of years of experience and insight and wisdom. And because we haven't caught up, there's kind of this, instead of saying, well, that's really interesting, we haven't caught up, we don't know about this yet, tell us more, there's kind of this arrogance about, you know, this hasn't been described within our realm of truth, and therefore it's wrong. and that's actually not very scientific. So to rely on this and to see, to trust on this intuition, and on your knowledge, but on the intuition that this knowledge, although maybe not part of the current paradigm, may actually be more helpful than what is available with our, you know, given our current state of ignorance in Western science. So, yeah. So Dan, tell us about your a situation where you felt professionally compromised in your providing care.
Thank you, Jan. Kavita, as you were saying just now, as you're experiencing the wisdom and your patience, there's something that's coming up with me, which is ultimately that through your experience and your intuition and your knowing, how would you do differently for your own family? And that is almost like a litmus paper or a clarity and inner knowing and intuition that you can bring into this. And so back to the patient with dementia, it's like you look at this and you're like, there's just something not right. You know, it's almost like how I'm explaining sort of the mask in the middle of the ocean or something. It's like there's just something that just does not feel in alignment with something that should be. And I think when you bring that to your own, what you'll do for yourself, for your family. And so now I'm kind of bringing it back to the answer is I think when I was doing a lot of OBGYN as a part of my family medicine training, I felt that there is a professional compromise that happens when attending to the birth of women in a hospital setting. Ultimately, we'd have a curve that we'd follow. If you were a first-time mother, this is how this should be developing. This is a Friedman curve, and we're saying, okay, this should take this many hours to develop. This is your cervical dilation, and if you're not following this, then you're basically outside the realms of what normal or the bell curve, and then we start intervening. And then ultimately, but that's an interesting space because we know that part of that experience is based on a woman's ability to feel safe in an environment. If you look at any animal, let's say a little cat, they're going to come into the little part of the barn or wherever it is, hidden from everything else, where they feel the most safe if they're going to give birth. And so ultimately we have these terrible halogen lights and people you don't even know wanting to do a cervical exam on you while you're about to. All of this changes the curve. And so all of a sudden I see something like this where someone is now getting interventions and they're moved along an experience of like, oh, well, now we're going to add a drug called Pitocin and we're going to get the uterine contraction stronger. And then we're like, oh, thank goodness it ended up in like an emergency C-section. Not to say that that's not one of the interventions that we have that could be extremely helpful in an emergent situation. But as a physician, going through this over and over again, when I made a choice with our own family, and ultimately it was my wife and Mia talking together, but really where she felt the most comfortable. Here is a physician that has now attended the birth of, you know, 100 women in a residency training and ready to, and when it came to our own children, they're born at home. Because ultimately you're outside of a setting that was dictated by rules and regulations that have nothing to do with the journey of our babies coming out and my wife's, you know, anatomy and how that all dances together. And so just to hold that in. And, you know, we had contingency plans, so we know how we're going to get to the hospital if we need to. But it's a decision that comes from the experience and wisdom of seeing when there is following the rules leads to interventions that might not be the choice. So in a situation that is fully healthy for yourself, how do you make that decision? Another thing that comes to mind that's a shorter anecdote, but there would be things like, you know, there's a time period where many patients were getting an MRSA, so a bacterial infection in the hospital, and we basically had a rule, of course we're not going to let somebody, we're not going to discharge somebody with this, you know, bacteria. And so we would take Bactroban or Mupirocin and make sure that it was in their nasal pharynx for a 5 to 7 day period, keep these people in a hospital for a longer period of time that something else could happen to them just to eradicate the bacteria from their nasal pharynx. Meanwhile, then we test and say, up, they no longer have MRSA because we're checking from the nares that we've been treating. They're fine. Are they eradicated? Do they still have it? It doesn't really matter because we basically have a rule of discharge. They no longer have a bacterial infection. But it doesn't really resonate with, do they have this bacteria still? Is it still in their wound? Is it still elsewhere in their body? But it's not in the place that we're testing for. So what are we doing there? I mean, we're just like, I'm outing something that exists within a hospital setting. But when you see that up close and personal, you realize that there's a rule that might have had a good reason for being there. It might have been part of the first do no harm. And then we set something up, and then we figure out how to make that rule a part of our discharge summary. And then by the end, it doesn't make as much sense. And we're actually not having the courage and conviction to understand why we're doing it in the first place and the difficult decision of maybe letting someone out without doing another 7 days that they're going to end up getting a hospital-acquired pneumonia or something.
Thank you, Dan. Some people say that capitalism is not the production of goods, but the production of bads and anti-bads. So that's what it sometimes looks like, eh? That we're trying to treat something and then we're chasing our own tail. We started out by highlighting that actually medical breakthroughs occur with courage, moments of courage and insight. And we kind of moved to fear, and how this actually is in the way of being open for this inner guidance. And Dan, I hear you highlight that our focus or the rules are very much about, if you like, the bell's curve, the middle of the bell's curve, while really the medical breakthroughs do not occur at the middle of the bell's curve. They occur the outliers, that's where progress is made, right? So what does it take for us as a profession, as individuals, as a profession, that we create a space where we're sensitive to new ideas that are not just some mind games, but they're kind of very strong inner clarity ideas, from a clear source? What can we do that we actually encourage such ideas and that we encourage to test them in line with our scientific understanding and values, and then put them in practice rather than crush them and as you said initially, Kavita, kind of ridicule our colleagues because they are actually ready to think something that the rest isn't ready to think. And this is, they're like gazillion. I mean, start with Galileo, start with, you know, I mean, like everybody coming up with new ideas was primarily ridiculed and crushed and pushed aside. So how can we do this? It should actually be our professional interest and value to support this. What needs to be changed?
Well, for starters, I think, you know, and because I work in a hospital environment, I feel that more doctors need to be involved in decision in administrative process. And because what is happening across the U.S. at least is doctors are systematically being taken out of the conversation. And the decisions are made by administrators who are not doctors. So they have no idea about this intricacy of patient care and how we deliver medicine. And so they make rules based on, you know, what is good for the hospital and whether that's financial, you know, notoriety, whatever it may be. And their intentions are not bad. I do think that there needs to be somebody who thinks about that too. You can't live on idealism. So there needs to be somebody who thinks about that. But on the other hand, I think what has happened, you know, is that we physicians have allowed ourselves to be systematically taken out of the conversation in the past, you know, maybe two decades or so. And we don't band together. That's one problem. You know, there's no such thing as a physician's union, for instance. So we don't advocate for ourselves or for each other. And so what happens is each person is working in their own silo. And then, you know, divide and conquer, right? That was the tactic, you know, that in the Indian independence movement, divide and conquer was the thing that the British did to, you know, remain in power. And that's really what has happened is we have kind of disbanded and we have allowed others to take over, people who really can't run a hospital without doctors. Right? What would you do without doctors? So, but it is because of our lack of unity and coming together and saying, no, we need to be a part of this conversation where, you know, all these things are taken into account. That's the first thing that I, in my opinion, needs to happen, is that we need to come back together and bring in the talent. Of course, we need people that do the administrating really well. They are good at that. There are the legal people who do that, and they should be part of that conversation. So there should be room at the table for everybody, including the actual people who are in the trenches, which are the doctors. And unless we are included in this conversation, I can tell you that no change is possible. Because, you know, if we are continuously going to be looking behind our backs, and we can't really, you know, do what we want because, you know, we are bound by all these external rules. And, you know, it's very nice to talk about mavericks in a situation like this. But when you are actually going through that with the possibility of you losing your job, your kids are in school, and, you know, people are relying on you, it's not fun. Right? It's nobody wants to be in that position. And this is why, you know, doctors have said, as long as I can take care of my patients, and kind of, if I'm left alone, I'll just conform to it. So it's a systemic problem. And I don't think we can solve systemic problems through, you know, through individual changes alone. Individual changes are required, but the system itself needs to be a rehaul, in my opinion.
Yeah, here's a call, very strong call for reclaiming sovereignty as a healer.
Yes, absolutely.
And in a way that sovereignty is guided not by a power game or by self-interest, but is really guided by the values that really make up the purpose of what we're doing every day, why we get up and why we are willing to do the long shifts and the nights and the weekends and the holidays. And
yeah, I mean, who in their right mind wants to be a doctor? I mean, think about that, right? With our long years of training and all of this, and then dealing with all of this, it's like you have to be insane, actually, to say, I still want to do this. And I think we are insane on this level, right? It's like, who wants to work long hours and deal with all of these problems and continuously look behind your backs? But we do it anyway, which is insane.
It is a peculiar condition, isn't it? Jen, what do you have in your defense of being a doctor? where do you see us go here?
Kavita, thank you so much for sharing the systematic discussion. I think one addition to that is actually that the patients have been systematically taken out of the conversation as well. And so you have the two most important people in the trenches there. And we say, you know, us as this mavericks in the trenches. But I look to just close this out at all the mavericks, every one of these patients that have shopped around and gone from doctor to doctor or clinic to clinic with the same constellation of symptoms, just trying to be met because they know there's something wrong or there's something going on with their child, and they're going by their own conviction alone because they know there's something going on there. There's something that's deeper. There's something that hasn't been diagnosed or treated, and that is an invitation. And so I love what Kavita is saying, and it's like, look, we need to band together, and there's ultimately we need to bring a voice to the patient themselves, and then that coming together is a revolution, is ultimately like you're cutting out all of the middle and you're saying, these are the people that need help, these are the people that are on this earth wanting to help, whether crazy or not, and there is a wonderful movement that can happen with that. And now we do have to articulate that. We do need some people to organize what a public health hospital, urgent care, acute care, what that could look like, but it's a reformulation of that. You know, there's tons of people that it's just not working at this moment. They're going in where they should be seeing someone for preventative care or chronic care, and they're showing up in an emergency room setting. It's just not in alignment with what needs to happen. And so the voice of the patients heard, the voice of the doctors, the healers heard, creates a new paradigm, and then everyone needs to listen to that because that actually is a capitalist movement. It's actually where the healing with the powers can be, and we just have to kind of do this. It's a challenge, though, because like what we're seeing elsewhere in our world, what happens is it gets really bad, it gets really shattered, it gets really broken before everyone realizes that we need a completely new paradigm, and then we jump. It's like a phase shift that continues to happen in evolution, and it will happen in medicine and healing today, and we're just voices that are bringing transparency to what is happening at the edges, because we're feeling a broken system, and you're hearing from some heart-based, you know, deep knowing intuitive souls that are just sharing what's not working for us. So this has been an honor, and it's been such a great conversation, and per usual great conversations, it's the beginning. It's the seeds for what's to come from here. So it's been really wonderful talking to you, Kavita and Jan. Thank you for asking these really incredible questions.
Well, thank you. Thanks, Dan, and thanks, Kavita. It's just such an honor and joy to have these conversations, courageous conversations, open-hearted conversations that really resonate and feel true and honest. And it would be wonderful if what we're kind of starting out here actually has a bit of a ripple effect and that it might infect others as an infectious disease physician. I like that idea, that we might be infectious with a courageous heart that is speaking up and inviting for a conversation, not to be right, but to actually move towards a system that feels right for the patients and the healthcare professionals who do remain at the core of this profession. So thanks a lot for being on the show. This has been really a great series with you. And I just want to acknowledge that, Dan is taking off time here from his clinic. And he continues to provide bespoke healing journeys for his patients. And you can contact him at drdandenenberg.com, and we'll provide that link in the description. And please also check out the amazing work of Kavita at Sabta Institute, sabta.institute. That's the link. There is so much to learn about the courage of the heart and how we can actually be an instrument of this life that we're serving. And Kavita is really masterfully sharing this, not only living it in the midst of it, but also sharing this as we've heard during these conversations. So thank you, Dan. Thank you, Kavita, for joining. It's been a real pleasure. And we continue our work. Have a great time.
Well, that's the end of this podcast series. We hope to bring our next groundbreaking series soon. If you like this series, you might also enjoy our accompanying book, Dare to Care, on Amazon. Join the Heart of Healthcare discussion at heartbasedmedicine.org, where you'll find lots more interesting interviews, articles, and training materials. See you there.
This has been a Heart-Based Medicine production. Thanks for listening.